From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how scientists discovered that the brain is the seat of thought and intelligence. We talk with science writer Carl Zimmer. His new book, Soul Made Flesh, The Discovery of the Brain and How It Changed the World, is about the 17th century doctor and scientist Thomas Willis, one of the founders of neurology. Also, moths. They're surprisingly colorful, furry, and spectacular to look at. We talk with artist Joseph Scheer. His new book collects his enlarged images of moths, for which he used a high-resolution scanner. And we talk with a scientist who studies moths and butterflies. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the reissue of the 1971 album Nilsson Schmilsson by Harry Nilsson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. officials in Iraq say a terrorist with links to al-Qaeda planned to try to provoke civil war as a way to fight the U.S.-led occupation. They cite a letter they attribute to a known terrorist. NPR's Emily Harris reports from Baghdad.
U.S. officials say the letter was written by Abu Musab Zarqawi, the man suspected of killing a U.S. diplomat in Jordan in 2002. Dan Senor, spokesperson for Iraq's U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer, says the 17-page letter proposed attacking important Shiite Muslim shrines and leaders as a way to start inter-ethnic fighting in Iraq. Senor said the strategy was focused on tearing Iraq apart. He also said the letter showed anti-U.S. fighters were having trouble recruiting in Iraq. Relations among ethnic groups are tenuous here, and people worry quietly about potential for civil war. Emily Harris, NPR News, Baghdad.
President Bush visited Missouri today to campaign for Congress to extend his tax cuts. Although parts of the economy, such as manufacturing, are still losing jobs, the president said he's hearing that the recovery is starting to create new jobs.
That's what I'm hearing all over the country. You know, 10 people here, 15 people there, but it adds up in America. It adds up because there's a lot of entrepreneurs and a lot of small businesses. In order to figure out how this economy is going to do and whether or not to be upbeat about, just listen to the business owners.
But Senator John Edwards, who's campaigning for the Democratic presidential nomination, told supporters in Virginia that the president is neglecting real job creation.
I've heard President Bush going around the country talking about providing for American security. Well, how about securing America's jobs and keeping our jobs here at home?
Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean has begun a two-day swing through Wisconsin ahead of next week's primary. He criticized the Democratic frontrunner in a speech to supporters in Madison. Gil Halstead reports from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Dean did not name any of his rivals in the race for the nomination, but the crowd of about 200 who turned out for his speech near the state capitol knew who he was talking about when he referred to Washington insiders.
Democrats who watched the popularity polls and cut bad deals with the White House are not the right people to stand up to George W. Bush.
During his speech, Dean compared his message to that of former Wisconsin Senator Bob La Follette, who voted against U.S. participation in World War I. But at stops planned in Green Bay and La Crosse over the next 2 days, Dean will likely stress his plan to replace the thousands of manufacturing jobs lost in the state over the past few years. Dean has said a win in Wisconsin is crucial to his bid for the nomination. For NPR News, I'm Gil Halstead in Madison.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 14 points to close at 10,579. The NASDAQ Composite Index was down 3 points to close at 2060. This is NPR News. The former bishop of the Phoenix Catholic Diocese took the witness stand today in his hit-and-run trial. Thomas O'Brien is charged with leaving the scene of a fatal car accident last June. Mark Moran reports from member station KJZZ.
Thomas O'Brien testified that he heard a loud crash on one side of his car the night he allegedly hit and killed a pedestrian in Phoenix. He says he thought he'd hit an animal or that someone had thrown a rock at his car and that he did not know he had hit a person. Experts have testified that poor lighting, the pedestrian's position in the street, and his dark clothing could have combined to make it difficult for O'Brien to see anyone in the street. O'Brien shut himself up in his house after the accident and only answered police questions after they traced the car allegedly involved to his house. 2 weeks before that, O'Brien sidestepped prosecution in a church sex abuse scandal. O'Brien did not report priests who were accused of molesting children to authorities, instead sending the priests to other congregations. O'Brien himself was not accused of sex abuse. For NPR News, I'm Mark Moran in Phoenix.
The rebellion in Haiti appears to have spread over the weekend. Witnesses said anti-government forces have taken control of at least 9 towns in the western part of the island nation, including the important port town of St. Mark. The local Red Cross says at least 40 people have been killed in the violence. Various rebel factions are trying to oust Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who held on to power in 2000 through legislative elections that were widely denounced as fraudulent. The opposition refuses to take part in new elections unless Aristide resigns, and that's something he's refused to do. In stocks, the S&P 500 lost 3 points to close at 11:39. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to look back to the time when scientists were just discovering the function of the brain through very primitive experimental brain surgery. My guest, Carl Zimmer, is the author of the new book, Soul Made Flesh: The Discovery of the Brain and How It Changed the World. It focuses on the work of Thomas Willis, one of the fathers of neurology, who began his surgical investigations into the brain in 1662. This was a time when many scientists were also alchemists, a time when many scientists believed that the soul was located in the liver and the heart, a time when a scientist could be put to death if his work challenged the teachings of the church. Thomas Willis was part of a circle of scientists and philosophers at Oxford University. Writer Carl Zimmer has reported on science for the New York Times, National Geographic, Newsweek, and Science. In the mid-1600s, when Willis was beginning his research, scientists believed that the heart was the center of thought, perception, and action. Scientists didn't yet know about the existence of nerves and didn't understand the importance of the brain.
The brain, as we think of it, the brain as this 3 pounds of flesh, the brain that we know as being billions of neurons that are trading signals and chemicals, no one knew the brain as being such a thing. The funny thing is that the one thing in the head that they were struck by were these little holes in the brain. If you were to cut off the top of someone's head and look in their head, you would see a few kind of squiggly little recesses right at the core of the brain. And so people started imagining that these must be very important, that they were what were called ventricles. And they had this idea that in life they were expanded to be these beautiful vaulted spheres and that spirits would rush through them. And these were spirits that you would actually breathe in from the air. In a sense, you were sort of breathing in part of the world's soul, and it became the spirits that would flow through your body. And they would go through these chambers, these ventricles, and then on their way into the rest of the body. But the brain itself, no one cared about.
Your book focuses on the research of Thomas Willis, who was a scientist in the 1600s, and who you consider the father, I guess people in the field consider him the father of neurology. When he started to investigate the brain, what was the current theory at the time of intelligence and perception?
You can get some interesting insights into what people thought about the mind and intelligence and the brain and so on by looking at contemporary sources like Shakespeare, for example. Or if you look at the journals of 17th century doctors, you get some interesting ideas. So intelligence really wasn't a factor then. I mean, people didn't talk about IQ. They didn't really even talk about idiocy versus intelligence. It just wasn't sort of on their radar. They saw people as being these combinations of humors, these strange substances like black bile and yellow bile, choler, phlegm. And when these got out of balance, they would alter a person's temperament. So we think of personality as being this thing that is the product of our brains and the way that our brains work and the way that the neurons are exchanging chemicals. No one had any sort of concept like this. So Thomas Willis was steeped in all these sorts of ideas. I mean, and so as a young doctor, he would try to apply them. He would try to apply the ideas of ancient doctors like Galen, for example, because that's what he had been taught. But there were just a lot of other ideas kind of roaming around at the time that were challenging this conventional wisdom, so that he began to wonder, for example, if I am treating an hysterical woman, a woman with hysteria, is it really the case that her womb is rising up in her belly, which is what Galen and everyone else believed? Or is there some other explanation that I should be looking for?
Thomas Willis was part alchemist and part physician. What did it mean to be an alchemist in the 1600s?
Well, alchemists were not really the sort of stereotype we have of them today as being from the bad old days before real science got started. They were investigating nature. They were doing experiments. They were trying to understand what matter was made of. And there was actually a long tradition of using alchemy for medicine, so trying to figure out how to create drugs that could transform the body in the same way the Philosopher's Stone was supposed to transform lead into gold. And so this was not something that Thomas Willis would learn in his lectures at Oxford. They were being taught the conventional wisdom from Galen and Aristotle and the other Greeks. But on the side, he was working for a woman who was a sort of a home doctor of sorts, and he was having to make these medicines based on alchemy. And so that got him interested in the whole concept, which helped to make him think about the body not as the four humors, whatever that means, but as sort of a place where chemical reactions took place. And so he wanted to know what were the chemicals that made up the body. Ultimately, his question became, what are the chemicals that make up the brain?
He performed a lot of surgery on corpses to remove and study the brain. What was the state of the art of the surgical procedure to remove the brain when he was doing his work in the 1600s?
A lot of people who were doing this would do something quite grisly. They would cut off sort of horizontal slices off the top of the head and just look down slice by slice and see what the brain looked like. Obviously, this made a total mess of the brain, and so people got kind of a confusing picture of it. So what Thomas Willis did was he would actually be able to take the brain out whole as one piece from the skull. Not only that, but some of the people that he worked with, Christopher Wren, for example, and Robert Boyle, had figured out ways of preserving organs by keeping them in alcohol and then injecting different dyes into the blood vessels to see what the blood vessels actually led to in the body. And so he could use these sort of techniques, along with microscopes even. He was the first person to use a microscope to look at nerves. And so with all these methods, he was able to look at the brain the way no one really had looked at it before.
What are some of the things that struck him most when he first saw a whole brain?
He was very impressed by it as a very elegant device. People were starting to think of the body as a machine, but no one really thought of the brain as a machine because it tended to look like just a lot of mush. But with his methods, he was able to appreciate just how intricately put together it is, how many different parts it actually has, how the blood vessels creep around to every little nook and cranny in the brain. He called it a curious quilted ball. And he also realized that these ventricles that had dominated our understanding of the anatomy of the head and were supposed to be where these spirits were, that had dominated our thinking for 1,000 years or more, that they were just empty holes, that they had nothing to do with the business of the soul.
Well, how did he get permission to perform this research on corpses?
Well, when Thomas Willis started, the convention was just to dissect the bodies of criminals who had been executed. But Thomas Willis started to change that. He would look at the diseases his patients had in their life, and then when they died, he would ask the families for permission to dissect them. This really hadn't been done before, but Thomas Willis was able to get the trust of people in a way that hadn't really been achieved before. And so he had this incredible supply of cadavers, and he could start looking at the brains of them. And not only that, but these were not criminals. These were often people of high birth. And so anything that he found in the brain, anything that he said about how the soul worked, he had to take very seriously, because you couldn't just dismiss it as being some pathology of a criminal who might have, you know, some kind of strange aberration because they were of low birth.
Now, he also did a lot of experiments on animals, dogs, for instance. What are some of the experiments he did on the brains of dogs?
One of the great ideas that Thomas Willis had was that different parts of the brain are responsible for different functions of the body, that you could actually look at a part of the brain and say, this is responsible for doing one thing, this is responsible for doing another thing over here. This is really where all modern neuroscience comes from, trying to parcel up the brain and figuring out its anatomy to figure out what it does. And so he was the first person to really talk about that, but he had to prove it. One of the things that he did was he did an experiment on a dog to show that one part of the brain near the base was responsible for kind of our involuntary functions, like the beating of our heart or the breathing of our lungs, whereas our voluntary motions and our thoughts were going on elsewhere. So what he did, and this is quite a grisly experiment, he would open up a dog's skull, he would damage part of the brain near the base, and then stitch the dog up and see what happened. Well, the dog suffered a pretty horrible death. Fortunately, not all of his experiments were quite as gruesome. He was able, for example, to show that there was this elegant network of blood vessels that supplied the brain with blood, and that you could, even if you cut off one artery going to the head, the others could compensate. And so he did this with a dog, and the dog, he reported afterwards, would follow him around the town as he went to visit his patients, was perfectly happy. And this was further proof to him that the brain was this wonderfully constructed device that had this essential supply of blood given to it in order to work.
My guest is Carl Zimmer, author of the new book, Soul Made Flesh, The Discovery of the Brain and How It Changed the World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Carl Zimmer, and he's a science journalist. His new book is called Soul Made Flesh, The Discovery of the Brain and How It Changed the World. And the book focuses on Thomas Willis, who is considered to be the father of neurology, and he did his work in the 1600s. What did Thomas Willis come to believe about the brain, its function, how it worked?
Thomas Willis came to believe what we all sort of take for granted, namely that everything that we consider part of our inner life, our emotions, our thoughts, our reasoning, all take place in the brain. And not only that, but they take place through chemical reactions. And not only that, but the different parts of the brain are responsible for doing different things. And so he saw this as making us having a lot in common with other animals. So, for example, a monkey, he was really surprised to see, had a brain very much like a human. And from this, he said, well, then monkeys must have sort of psychological lives, as it were, a lot like ours. And so you could use the same principles to explain a human soul as you could an animal soul. Now, he wanted to stress that this did not make him an atheist. He, in his prefaces to his book, he kept saying, I am not an atheist, please take it from me. And he would dedicate his books to the Archbishop of Canterbury to make that clear. He also believed that there was a rational soul within the brain that would survive after death, that was immaterial. But ironically, it was really sort of a captive in this life. It could only see the things and experience the things that this other soul, this material soul, brought to it, that presented to it. It's sort of like a king who is sort of captive in his castle.
Before Thomas Willis, the popular theories were that spirits or the humors affected, you know, intelligence and emotion. Did Willis end up believing that there was still some role for spirits in the body?
Thomas Willis kept on talking about spirits, but what he was talking about when he said spirits was something very different from what came even a century before. In the Renaissance, people believed that there were lots of different spirits in the body. There were vital spirits coming out of the heart and other spirits coming out of the liver. They're responsible for your desires and your appetites, and the animal spirits that were in these ventricles. Not only that, but there were souls in everything around us. There were souls in plants and in the sky, and there were spirits moving around, sort of enacting their will. And what Thomas Willis did was he took all those ideas and made them mechanical, made them chemical. He said, yes, there are spirits, but all they are special kind of corpuscles, he called them. You could think of them as molecules or atoms or some sort of information-bearing thing. And in this way, he was really part of the scientific revolution, which was trying to take these mystical souls out of nature.
The soul was really the province of the church. How did the church react to Willis's theories of the brain and its relationship to the soul?
This is a kind of puzzling thing, because if you look at the facts, Thomas Willis should have gotten into a lot of trouble because he was opening up this new science of the brain that would undermine all of the sort of pat explanations that the church had accepted. And the church was very much on its guard against all this, what was called the mechanical philosophy. They were outraged that you could try to say that a person would do something with as much free will in the matter as a fire had a choice of burning. They thought this was outrageous and it was a threat to the church itself. But for some reason, Thomas Willis didn't really get into much trouble. And part of that is that he was really a hero to the church. He had been a soldier in the English Civil War, fighting for the king, fighting for the Church of England. After the king was executed and Oliver Cromwell took over, Thomas Willis hosted a secret church in his own home where people from the Church of England could actually worship. And he kept that going for years until Charles II came back and the Restoration occurred. And in the Restoration, he was considered, you know, the most devout doctor in England. And yet, here he was promoting what we see today as some really quite revolutionary ideas.
How did his research and his theories affect the religious teachings of his time?
Well, what happened was that the church started backing away from insanity in a sense that it was no longer considered a matter for the church. The church would often accuse, for example, Quakers of being fanatics, of you know, just being nuts. And, you know, the Quakers at the time were doing some pretty radical things, like walking around naked in the streets to jolt people out of their complacency. But after Thomas Willis started sort of explaining human nature according to the brain, the church started to say, well, these people just must have, you know, disordered brains, and we just need to send them to the doctors. And so this was a real fundamental shift that occurred. And remarkably, the church that had been so disturbed by the implications of the scientific revolution through Thomas Willis ended up embracing one of the central parts of it.
Were there things that the church had seen as demonic possession that it started to see as a disorder of the brain?
Yes, absolutely. Epilepsy, for example, had for centuries been considered a sign of possession. Nightmares had as well. How else to explain how someone could close their eyes and feel that they were being transported to some distant place? Or how could you explain how someone would start raving and screaming and foaming at the mouth? There must be demons. Thomas Willis looked very carefully at these explanations, and he said, I don't think so. And he used his new kind of neurology to say epilepsy is really just a chemical imbalance. It's the explosions that normally happen in a very orderly way in the body getting out of control, so that you're having sort of a kind of a wildfire of the mind, as it were. And so the church would back away from these sort of disorders, saying, okay, well, these too are the province of medicine. They're not for the church anymore.
When did Willis's ideas about the brain start to catch on?
Surprisingly, they caught on really fast. A lot of scientists have had to suffer for years in obscurity before they really grab the attention of their society, but Thomas Willis's first book about the brain, it's called The Anatomy of the Brain, came out in 1664, and it was an immediate hit. It went through four editions in the first year. I think it went through about 20 editions all told. It was being published well into the 1800s. And his illustrations, which were done by Christopher Wren, you could still see in textbooks in the 20th century. So these ideas took hold immediately, not just his ideas about how the brain was structured or how the brain worked, but his ideas about the soul and about diseases of the soul and of the brain. It's probably a sign of how ready society was for an explanation like his. The scientific revolution had been going on for quite a while at that point, and people were starting to be able to accept these ideas. And so he just came along at the right time and was smart enough to put all these things together.
When Thomas Willis died, did he donate his own brain to science?
There's no record of that.
I just really wonder if he would have wanted his skull cut open and investigated after death.
I'm sure he would have been happy for someone to look at his brain.
He probably would have wanted to do it himself. I bet he was dying.
He would have loved to have known what it looked like.
Yeah. So, thank you. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, well, thanks. It's been a real pleasure.
Carl Zimmer is the author of the new book, Soul Made Flesh, The Discovery of the Brain and How It Changed the World. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by BarnesandNoble.com, offering more than 30 million used and out-of-print books at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the Sundance Channel, presenting Tanner 88, an original series from creators Robert Altman and Gary Trudeau, new episodes every Tuesday at 9 p.m. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Moths aren't the drab relative of the butterfly. They're actually colorful, furry, and elaborately patterned, as you can see in the enlarged images in Joseph Scheer's book Night Vision. Coming up, we talk with Scheer and lepidopterist Mark Epstein. And Ken Tucker reviews the reissue of Harry Nilsson's 1971 album, Nilsson Schmilsson. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Like a lot of other people, I think of butterflies as beautiful and moths as boring pests. Boy, was I surprised when I opened the new book Night Vision, The Secret Designs of Moths. The book features spectacular enlarged images of moths, which reveal that moths have richly colored, furry, elaborately patterned wings. These enlarged, detailed images are amazingly beautiful, but also kind of creepy. They were created by Joseph Scheer by placing the moths on a high-resolution scanner. Scheer co-directs the Institute of Electronic Art at Alfred University in New York. A little later, we'll meet his co-author, Mark Epstein, a scientist who studies moths and butterflies. Joseph, there's an illustration of a certain moth. It's illustration number 27 that I'd like you to describe. Would you describe it for us?
That would be Hypoprepia fucosa, and that's a common name is a lichen moth or painted lichen moth. It's about, in real life, about a little over a half an inch across, and it is has these wonderful pinks and reds and yellows and charcoal grays, dark borders on it, on the underwing and the top wing is kind of striped. Being so small in real life and then being able to blow it up larger, you get to see this incredible amount of detail of each little scale. And next to it is a full-page enlargement, which is the size of the book, which is about 14 by 12 inches almost. And it then shows you what each little scale looks like.
Well, you know, I have to say that among the things that amaze me about this photograph is you have these beautiful multicolored wings, and at the end of the wings is a charcoal color fringe. Around the moth's head, if I may use that word, there's almost like hair, like a little tuft of hair. The antenna has this, what would you call those spiky things sticking out of the antenna?
Pectins or combs or...
Okay. And then you have a blow-up just of the wing on the opposing page, and the wing is just like, it's like furry. It's kind of magnificent. Joseph Scheer, would you explain the technical process that you use to get this high-resolution, extra-large blow-up of a half-inch-sized moth?
What I use is a very high-resolution flatbed scanner. It's similar to what most people have in their homes and offices these days, but it is capable of producing an image with up to 14,000 pixels per inch, and it can do it just with a stunning and exquisite detail. I actually live in a very remote part of western New York, and I go out at night throughout the summer, and I collect the moths. I had to develop a technique of getting them very flat, and I prepare them in a way very different than a Lepidopterist does for collections, because there can't be a pin in them. So I had to devise a technique for spreading them and drying them before I put them on the scanner. And then each scan takes about, up to an hour, depending on the resolution and how I'm scanning it. And then I work on it a little bit in the computer, make sure everything's correct, color corrected and that, and then they actually end up being large format iris prints that are 3 feet by 4 feet.
How did you start photographing insects through this high-resolution scanner? Yeah.
Well, I don't see it as photography, and I don't see myself as a photographer. I come from a printmaking background, which had a lot of drawing and painting involved. And so I'm not looking through a lens or working with any photochemicals, but I think at the point that we live in today where, you know, technology has changed all our lives, you know, the borders between mediums have all broken down. So it looks somewhat photographic. It looks somewhat like a painting. It looks like a watercolor. It has all these different qualities in the work.
Oh, so when you got your high-resolution scanner at the Institute for Electronic Arts, what made you think, oh, I think I'll try putting insects in here and see how they look when they're blown up?
It actually started quite as a whim. It was donated to us by the Creo Corporation, and they brought it in and sent in a technician to set it up because it's a very complicated piece of equipment. He calibrated it and said, okay, it's ready to scan. And in the room there was a plant, and it had a tiny little gnat flying around it. And I thought, well, if this thing is really that powerful, I just grabbed the gnat as a joke, you know, not being serious at all, and threw it under the scanner and scanned it. And when the image came up, I was just like, floored because it was so incredibly beautiful that I saw this little tiny insect that I would normally just dismiss that had these beautiful multifaceted compound eyes. It had hairs all over its body. Its wings were pearlescent metallic blues and greens. And I thought, oh my God, you know, if that looks like, you know, so incredible, what do other insects look like?
And what was so compelling about moths that led you want to do a whole study of them and then a whole book?
Well, I started then just doing all sorts of insects and, coming being an artist and not ever studying Lepidoptera or entomology before, I just started around learning how to collect insects, you know, self-teaching, being self-taught of how to do it and getting some books and, you know, a butterfly net and all that and running around, you know, looking totally ridiculous, but capturing all these things. And I thought, well, I wanted to make an installation that could fill like a gallery space with maybe 50, 60 of these very large prints. I thought it'd be a very powerful impact. And so I, started collecting everything. And I thought by the end of the summer, I could get maybe 200 species if I was really, really lucky and worked really hard. But by the end of 2 weeks, I had over 500 species. And then I realized just how many, you know, thousands and thousands of species of insects are, you know, out there and around us, you know, every day. And I teach in an art building that has lots of big windows, and at night moths would always fly in, and I would find them, you know, during the week in the windowsills or on the floor, and I would pick them up, and I thought they were really amazing. And after learning how that, you know, to set up an actual a light station to attract them, I enlisted the help of my friend Mark Klingensmith, because he had a 100-acre property just outside of Alfred, the little village of Alfred, where Alfred University exists. And we set up these lights and faithfully for the last, you know, 5 years, almost every night in the summer when the weather is well, we go out there and see what species fly in. And I guess to date, we have over 1,000 different species that I've collected and scanned in and trying to identify. And that's where I, at that point, started to enlist the help of Mark Epstein, who was at the Smithsonian at the time, how do you go about identifying these things?
Well, let me introduce Mark Epstein, who's a lepidopterist, who is, among other things, a research associate at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., and a lepidopterist is an expert in butterflies and moths. Mark Epstein, are you astonished by these images, these blown-up high-resolution images of moths, or did you already know how beautiful moths could be?
Yes, I did. I had an fair advantage, and one that actually many lepidopterists have, and that is that we look at them under microscopes. So a lot of the detail and the softness and the things that Joseph has been talking about are more apparent, and that's part of what engaged me in getting involved in this project, is that it was a really great way to sort of show the world what we already see. And even Joseph's description of the little fungus gnat at the beginning of the program is very typical of a lot of insects, that once you look at them under magnification, you see a beauty that is not always readily obvious.
Well, Mark Epstein, why don't we see these magnificent colors of the moth? I can understand why we don't see the details in the antenna and the hair and fur on the moth, but the colors, how come we don't see all these bright colors when we see most of these little moths?
Actually, I think it's just because we just don't look at them, because they are so little. And, of course, Joseph is selecting out the prettier ones, but if the public spent time, like the lepidopterists do, you know, putting a sheet out at night with a illuminated with a light, a ultraviolet or a mercury vapor, you would see the colors. It's just that, you know, this draws the attention that, you know, normally people don't go and do that.
Why do moths mostly fly at night, and why are they drawn to the light?
Generally what we are all taught, though it's still not very well understood, is that the moths, especially the male moths, are navigating and using a distant light source, which in nature would have been the moon, to basically sort of, you know, go on a particular course. And then they encounter a plume of pheromones, which are the chemical attractant that the female moth is broadcasting out into the air. So the moths, in a sense, are kind of zigzagging around using the moon as sort of a compass and then encountering a pheromone, and then that guides them into the female. And, of course, you know, being nocturnal, these type of moths, being at flying at the nighttime, need, you know, more of a chemical cue, because visually it would be impossible to detect the female moths.
So when we put on a porch light and all the moths from the community gather around, are we confusing them?
Yes, we are. Yes, and that's part of why mercury vapor lights have been controversial, because they really pull in a, not for the collecting purpose, but for the purpose of, you know, illuminating our cities, that a lot of moths get basically fried by them, get attracted into them. And it's often given as one of the reasons why there's sort of a decline in the numbers of moths from what we once used to see.
My guests are Joseph Scheer and Mark Epstein, authors of the new book Night Vision, The Secret Designs of Moths. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Joseph Scheer and Mark Epstein, two of the authors of the new book Night Vision, The Secret Designs of Moths. It features Scheer's enlarged images of moths that he created with a high-resolution scanner. Epstein contributes scientific commentary about moths. He's a lepidopterist. Now that you know how beautiful moths are when you can see them enlarged, can you see any of this beauty without enlarging them? If you're just looking at your porch light and there's a bunch of moths flying around, can you see the colors? Can you see anything that is so attractive and compelling to you when the image is blown up?
Well, sometimes the strange postures that the live moths have do obscure some of these things. They might roll their wings in such a way that, or the front wing might cover a bright red hind wing, which is a device that's often used to scare off birds. So sometimes the moths actually do things as living creatures that look very different from the way they're portrayed here in the book.
So they're hiding their own beauty.
Yes, and sometimes that's for different reasons. Like I say, that could be used as a defense, to really look like a piece of wood or, you know, just not stand out. Also, it's interesting, sometimes what we consider to be really beautiful, when we think about it in the context, might actually be a device to be hidden. For example, I work on some moths that the males are sort of clear wing and sort of drab, and the females have a bright green stripe on their wings. And normally, butterflies and moths like birds, you tend to find the males are more attractive, but in this case, really the females to our eye are prettier, yet it's that green stripe on the females that actually make them more hidden and more protected. So a lot of times it takes sort of perspective to thinking about kind of what world the moth lives in to kind of almost readjust what our aesthetic is of them.
Is the green camouflage?
Yes.
Mark Epstein, when you look at the wings of the moth blown up in high resolution detail, you can see this fur, is that the right word, on the wing?
Actually, it's what we call scales, which is essentially what the word or the name Lepidoptera means. Lepid is scale in Latin, and optera is winged, so scale winged is what we're seeing. And a lot of times these scales, which is a wonderful thing about this book, you can see the variation. You know, some are very hair-like, and that's what gives that woolly appearance, whereas others are more flattened. We tend to think of butterflies as having more of the flattened type scales, which give them a little crisper kind of look than kind of these woolly looking moths.
And is it the scales that we're seeing when we see the kind of like white dust that moths sometimes leave?
Yes.
What's the function of the scales on the moth's wings?
Actually, one theory is that it's a very good device for if they were to get caught into a spider's web to be able to free themselves. They're also somewhat repellent to water, so it's a way to avoid getting inundated with water in nature. Also, it's a defensive, well, just like with the spider web in general, anything that allows them to escape in some way, you know, by getting brushed off, sort of the Teflon effect, being able to kind of free themselves. That's a useful device. But then probably most important is that it's a way that they can recognize each other with mate recognition in close range. Even moths, which, you know, are basically relying less on vision, still are seeing, you know, ultraviolet and certain reflections off the scales, and how they're arranged is one of the ways of species recognition.
It's only through blowing up the images of these moths through new high-tech equipment, this high-resolution scanner, that you're able to see the color, the texture, and the beauty of these moths. Does this make you think that there's a whole world that's invisible to you, that's too small to see, and it's a world of, like, mystery and beauty? Joseph?
Well, it seems it's so funny because, like, I've started to look at things closer and closer, and I have friends who laugh at me because I'm always, like, hunched over looking at things and looking at the minutiae things, like how structures come together. So it's a whole world of fascination now that I have of, like, looking at the micro and, the micro and the nano, how beautiful it can be.
Beautiful, you know, but maybe creepy sometimes too?
Well, you know, there is that kind of, like, when I first started doing, like, this wonderful kind of horrific beauty, there's, like, the tent caterpillar moth. It's a total furball. And the large prints I have, when you first go up to it, you kind of gasp because it looks like a teddy bear. But it also has this kind of visceral thing that if you can almost feel it in your mouth, it becomes so creepy because it's, like, so textury and hairy. And so it draws you in, and it kind of repulses you a little bit at the same time. Some of the, you know, the images. And to me, that's really interesting. How can something have that power?
And do you use mothballs for your clothes in the winter?
Actually, I don't. You know, I hate the way those things smell. So, you know, actually, they put those in the Smithsonian. All the collections all smell like that because they have the mothballs in with the moths, you know. So, you know, it has that smell. And
we are doing away with them, though.
Why do you have the mothballs in with the moths?
That actually protects the moths from other insects that get in, like carpet beetles. However, we are phasing out the use of naphthalene or mothballs, and are freezing our collections as a way to, because mothballs really aren't, you know, that great for humans.
Well, thank you both so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, it was great.
Joseph Scheer co-directs the Institute of Electronic Art at Alfred University in New York. Mark Epstein is a lepidopterist who now works with the California Department of Food and Agriculture. Their new book is called Night Vision: The Secret Designs of Moths.
Men cluster to me like moths around the flame, and if their wings burn, I know I'm not to blame. Falling in love again, never wanted to. What am I to do? I can't help it.
Marlene Dietrich recorded in 1939. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a reissue of the 1971 album Nilsson Schmilsson by Harry Nilsson. This is Fresh Air. Harry Nilsson's 1971 album Nilsson Schmilsson has just been reissued. Nilsson, an American singer-songwriter with a reputation for reclusiveness and a gift for catchy pop melodies, was cited by the Beatles as one of their favorite performers. He collaborated with John Lennon on the 1974 album Pussycats. Rock critic Ken Tucker says Nilsson Schmilsson holds up as a precursor to today's pop and for its unmatched inventiveness.
Gotta get up, gotta get out, gotta get home before the morning comes.
The cover of Nilsson Schmilsson is a fuzzy black and white snapshot of Harry Nilsson in his bathrobe, sleepy looking, cradling a hash pipe in his hand. He commenced this album with Gotta Get Up, a bit of self-prodding that was both typically jaunty in its tunefulness and wry in its lyric. It was Nilsson's low-key way of telling his cult following that he was rousing himself for something bigger than usual. It was his first time working with producer Richard Perry, who made unusually daring, commercially successful albums with everyone from Barbra Streisand to the ukulele-strumming Tiny Tim. Together, Nilsson and Perry went for a varied sound. It included lushly orchestrated songs that rendered Nilsson's thin but powerful voice poignant.
Some nights I go to sleep without you.
One of Nilsson's charms was that he wrote about ordinary things, tooling around in your car, appreciating the sight of a moonbeam. It's not hard to hear what the Beatles liked about him. He could move from sunniness to absurdity to dark melancholy, while always experimenting with the outer edges of pop songcraft.
Early in the morning, I can't do right. Had a little fight with my baby last night, and it's early in the morning. Don't you know it's early in the morning? Early in the morning, I ain't got nothing, no nothing but the blues.
Nilsson's career was full of odd twists and contradictions. The man who got kicked out of an L.A. nightclub with John Lennon for wearing tampons taped to their heads also wrote the delicate children's music song cycle that became the cartoon called The Point. A singer-songwriter valued for his eccentric originality, his two biggest hits were versions of other people's songs. Fred Neil's Everybody's Talking, used as the theme for the 1969 movie Midnight Cowboy. And his only number one hit single was a song by the band Badfinger.
No, I can't forget this evening, or your face as you were leaving, but I guess that's just the way the story goes. You always smile, but in your eyes your sorrow shows. Yes, it shows. No, I can't forget tomorrow, when I think of all my sorrow. Well, I had you there, but then I let you go. And now it's only fair that I should let you know what you should know.
Harry Nilsson died in 1994 of a heart attack at age 52. It's said that he drank and drugged a lot. This reissue was overseen with excellent liner notes by the actor Curtis Armstrong, whom you may remember as the Nebuchadnezzar Herbert on TV's Moonlighting in the 80s. And it includes an alternate take of Gotta Get Up that's more explicitly hungover. Nilsson put out some good albums after this one, but he never showed more range and ambition than he did on Nilsson Schmilsson. I just read that Coke may use a song from this album, Coconut, in a campaign to promote its new Diet Coke with lime. Only thing is, they may not use Nilsson's original version. Story of the guy's life.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the reissue of Nilsson Schmilsson.
Brother bought a coconut, he bought it for the dime. His sister had another one, she paid it for the lime. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and poured up. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and poured up. She put the lime in the coconut.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne Mabel Donato, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross.
Ain't there nothing I can take? I said, doctor, can we leave this belly yet? Now let me get this straight. Put the lime in the coconut, you drank and pour up. Put the lime in the coconut, you drank and pour up. Put the lime in the coconut, you drank and pour up. Put the lime in the coconut, you called your doctor, woke him up. Said, doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said,
Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by TIAA Cref, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide, TIAA-CREF.org, and from Nonesuch Records, featuring mezzo-soprano Lorraine Hunt Lieberson's recording of Bach cantatas numbers 82 and 199. More information available at nonesuch.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, songwriter Jimmy Webb. He wrote By the Time I Get to Phoenix, The Wichita Lineman, and MacArthur Park. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising. She'll find the note I left hanging.